Coming up, Tim O'Brien on the Supreme Court's consideration of same-sex marriage, including voices of the justices. Also, the Episcopal Bishop of Maryland, Eugene Sutton, on the violence in Baltimore, the messages it sent, and what the replies should be. Plus, Bob Faugh on conversions to Judaism.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, faith leaders continued appealing for calm in the wake of the Baltimore riots that were triggered by the death of Freddie Gray. He was a 25-year-old black man who died after suffering a spinal injury while in police custody. The riots resulted in extensive property damage and more than 250 arrests. Clergy were among those leading peaceful demonstrations against police violence in Baltimore and several other cities. The National Council of Churches said, quote, African American men and women are dying at the hands of the police, and the nation must correct this injustice immediately. We'll have more on Baltimore later in the program. We have a special report and analysis today by Tim O'Brien on the arguments made this week to the Supreme Court about whether gay marriage should be legal throughout the U.S. Tim has covered the court for many years and reports today with the help of audio of parts of the justices' discussion.
Demonstrators on both sides of the issue filled the plaza outside the Supreme Court Tuesday. Some had been standing in line for 4 days in the hope they might get in to watch the historic arguments. Those who did found much the same passion inside from the lawyers and justices, although speaking in much lower voices. All eyes were on Justice Anthony Kennedy, widely perceived to be the fifth vote in support of marriage equality. Kennedy is the author of the court's three landmark victories for gays and lesbians, but no sooner had the argument begun when Kennedy noted that same-sex marriage is a recent development, and he expressed misgivings about tinkering with a definition of marriage that had been around for millennia.
I don't even know how to count the decimals when we talk about millennia. This definition has been with us for millennia. And it's very difficult for the court to say, oh, well, we know better.
Was Kennedy having a change of heart? Justice Antonin Scalia, the court's most forceful opponent of any constitutional recognition of same-sex marriage, jumped in, asking the lawyer for gay couples.
Do you know of any society prior to the Netherlands in 2001 that permitted same-sex marriage?
As a legal matter, Your Honor?
As a legal matter.
I am not.
Not a single other society until the Netherlands in 2001. And you're telling me they were all, I don't know what. You're asking us to decide it for this society when no other society until 2001 ever had it.
And when attorney Mary Bonato complained that states were denying a whole class of people the benefits of the institution of marriage, Chief Justice John Roberts took exception.
You're not seeking to join the institution. You're seeking to change what the institution is. A fundamental core of the institution is the opposite-sex relationship, and you want to introduce into it a same-sex relationship.
Roberts also expressed concern that forcing states to recognize same-sex marriage would close off debate on a new and important societal issue.
It was not going well for the proponents of same-sex marriage, whose lawyer got hammered by the more conservative justices. But when the lawyer representing states wanting to ban same-sex marriage rose to speak, the court's more liberal justices challenged him, too. Justice Stephen Breyer said the states had offered no logical justification for denying gays the right to marry.
So they have no possibility to participate in that fundamental liberty. That is, people of the same sex who wish to marry. And so we ask, why? And the answer we get is, well, people have always done it.
No.
You know, you could have answered that one the same way when you talk about racial segregation.
Attorney John Birch, on behalf of the states, responded that marriage serves the state's interest in procreation. Several justices noted that many heterosexual couples don't have children and that many same-sex couples do. Although no formal announcement is expected before late spring, the justices met in their very private conference room the next day and tentatively decided the case. The vote is secret, it rarely changes, and there's very little discussion. In fact, the only time all nine justices discuss the case in any depth is at the hearing in court. And sometimes, justices will speak to one another through the lawyer. Listen as Justice Antonin Scalia raises a question about the possible religious ramifications of requiring states to allow same-sex marriage.
Is it conceivable that a minister who is authorized by the state to conduct marriage can decline to marry two men, if indeed this court holds that they have a constitutional right to marry? He's an instrument of the state. I don't see how you could possibly allow that minister to say, I will only marry a man and a woman. I will not marry two men.
Other justices took over the conversation.
Counselor, there have been anti-discrimination laws in various states, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Anti-discrimination laws regarding gay people.
Correct.
And in any of those states, have ministers been forced to do gay marriages?
Of course not, Your Honor.
It's called Congress shall make no law respecting the freedom of religion.
After 2.5 hours in court, the arguments continued outside.
What this case is really about is love and democracy. I think what we talked about today is that you can love your neighbor no matter what their sexual orientation is, what choices they make about their life, and still have a disagreement about what marriage means. And the question is, who gets to decide the meaning of marriage? Is it people acting through the democratic process, or is it the federal courts? And our position has been, it's the people.
The Constitution promises equal protection and due process and liberty to all right now. It's not a popularity contest. The court, absolutely, it's their job to make sure that every individual's liberty and equality is protected regardless of state laws. And I wish I had certainly said that in the states where marriage has happened, what happens is people see the joy, they see the commitment, and they come to support the marriages.
Most of the justices at one point or another expressed deep misgivings about forcing states to allow same-sex marriage. They do have a fallback position, requiring those states that do not allow same-sex marriage to at least recognize the marriages performed in those states that do. A compromise that neither side wants, but one that might allow the court to revisit the issue at a later date. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington.
About those recordings, the court itself records and releases its tapes. In other news, faith-based humanitarian groups continued rushing aid to Nepal following the devastating earthquake in that country that killed more than 6,000 people. Catholic Relief Services and World Vision were among those delivering supplies to the worst affected areas, but accessing remote villages has been difficult because of Nepal's rough terrain. The UN said that of the 8 million people who've been affected by the earthquake, 1.5 million are in dire need of food. At the Vatican, at a conference on environmental issues, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called fighting climate change an urgent moral imperative. He also met privately with Pope Francis, who will release an encyclical on climate change in the next few months. At his weekly audience, Francis addressed the subject of wage inequality between men and women. He said the discrepancy is a scandal. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom released its annual report documenting the worst religious freedom offenders around the world. The independent body recommended that the State Department add 8 more nations to its list of countries in which religious freedoms are the most routinely and severely violated, among them Iraq, Syria, Nigeria, and the Central African Republic. In Pennsylvania, the first U.S. Catholic Church official convicted in the clergy sex abuse scandal was ordered back to prison this week. Monsignor William Lynn was convicted in 2012 for his role in covering up sex abuses by priests he supervised. He served 18 months of a 3 to 6 year sentence in state prison before his conviction was reversed. He has since been under house arrest, but his conviction was reinstated this week by the state's Supreme Court. Now, this week's racial upheaval in Baltimore, the messages it sent and what their replies should be. Eugene Sutton is the Episcopal Bishop of the Diocese of Maryland. Bishop, welcome back here.
Thank you, Bob.
What were the most important messages that came out of this violence?
Well, I think one of the most important messages is that eventually justice has to be done in order for there to be peace. This past week in Baltimore has been very difficult for us. On Monday, the city exploded in many of its parts, and on Monday evening, many of its neighborhoods were burning and looting was happening. On Tuesday morning, we wept, as we did Monday night. We wept, we grieved over the loss. But then we picked ourselves up.
But it was almost as if everybody had kind of decided, gangs and church leaders, and everybody said, oh, wait a minute.
It took many parts of very many communities to make peace in Baltimore. You mentioned the gang leaders, the Bloods and the Crips, had a historic agreement to say they would not be fighting each other this week, and they were going to help quell the violence. Religious leaders from all over the city, Christian, mainly, Muslim, and Jewish leaders, got out on the streets and in their congregations and really proclaimed a message of hope and of nonviolence and peace. City officials did the same.
Yeah. So now the policemen have been charged with...
Yes, the six policemen have been charged in the death of Freddie Gray, who died while they were in his custody.
So what are the immediate steps that now need to be taken?
Well, we're so happy that those policemen were charged, because this has been going on for many years, and that gave rise to a lot of the rage. Well over 100 incidents have of police abuse have been recorded in the last couple of years of persons dying and being injured in police custody. That has given rise to rage. So what needs to be done is exactly what has started to happen in Baltimore now: accountability for brutality. I may mention one other thing. We know that black-on-black crime is a big problem in the communities. And we expect the police officers to protect us from the criminals. But when the officers are themselves the abusers, then that gives rise to rage. And we saw that on Monday.
And you've said, I think, and others have, that the wonder is that it didn't break out earlier.
Yes, we weren't surprised that that there was a conflagration on Monday. The biggest surprise in the black community was that it hadn't happened earlier. The city has paid out millions of dollars in abuse cases. But it's not just that. It is the cycle of hopelessness and poverty and violence that has been building up for years.
Well, let me ask you about that, because there are things that have to be done and will be done, I'm sure, right away. And the church can be involved in that. But down the road, the big things, it seems to me, that have to be done have to do with jobs and schools, primarily. Yeah. So what can the church do to help that happen?
Well, the church has a moral voice that it can use, and saying to its members, we need to create jobs. You mentioned jobs, of course, and that lack of jobs gives rise to more poverty, ill housing, no good schools, and life expectancy. What a lot of people don't realize is that 15 Baltimore neighborhoods have life expectancies lower than that of North Korea. 8 neighborhoods in Baltimore have a lower life expectancy than Syria, and Syria is at war. We are talking about dire conditions, not all over the city, but the poverty in Baltimore. If those 8 neighborhoods were a nation, it would be one of the poorest nations in the world. And what the church can do about that is give is help a partner with the private sector and with government to say, what can we do to create jobs, have better schools? It's going to take all of us. It's not just the church's duty. It's not just the government's duty or the private sector. It's all of us working together, and we've started to do that in Baltimore.
And very quickly, you had an occasion after a meeting this past week when you and everybody in the church went out in the streets.
Oh, yes. It's the church should never lose its voice, and I really mean that literally. Just last night, I was with a church group. It was one of our wealthiest churches in Baltimore, predominantly white church. But they were in downtown, and some of those stores were looted. After the prayer service for Baltimore, we literally walked the streets singing, bearing the cross. And many people in the community, the homeless, drivers, they were honking their horns, and they were clapping for us and taking pictures, and they were basically saying, thank you. Thank you for being out here. You give us hope, and we know that you are with us. Imagine a congregation of mostly white folk singing for Freddie Gray, who died. That's the kind of thing that the church needs to do, bring people together.
Many thanks, Eugene Sutton, the Episcopal Bishop of Maryland.
Thank you.
For many years, Jewish leaders have been concerned about Jews who say they have no religion. But we have a story today about the experiences of converts to Judaism. Bob Fall reports from Phoenix, Arizona.
Having converted not once but twice, first to Reform and then to Orthodox Judaism, Rabbi Shmuley Yanklovitz is something of an expert on conversions.
Both of my conversions were incredibly intense and transformative. And in my experience as a rabbi, this is the norm, that is a very deliberate and intentional process that affects one's family, one's lifestyle, one's sense of community, one's values.
Since his mother was not Jewish by tradition, Yanklovitz was not considered Jewish, so he first converted to follow the faith of his father. The conversion of French-born Catholic Iris Feinstein, engaged to a Jewish doctor, started with curiosity.
I just wanted to understand better what I was, you know, doing. I was going to Shabbat, but I didn't understand exactly the whole meaning of it. So I decided to take classes just to learn about it.
In her Arizona kitchen preparing challah bread for the Jewish Sabbath dinner, Diane Faith Lilly says she converted to Judaism because her husband is Jewish and because it offered her more than the type of Christianity she had known.
There was action involved. It wasn't based on belief. That you had to actually do something.
Live it.
You had to live it. You had to do something. I think I was really seeking something that required more, because I feel like God wants you to do. And so to really know God, it's a process of doing, not just believing.
Faith Lilly converted to Reform Judaism first. Conversion, she says, was a voyage into a strange, often perplexing new world.
There's not a roadmap, and there's not a process where anybody really sits down. Like, the Reform rabbi didn't say, okay, just to let you know, this is what we believe, and this is what the conservative branch believes, and this is what the Orthodox believe. You know, are you sure you're in the right spot?
Now having mastered once unfamiliar routines, like properly setting her table for the Shabbat meal, Virginie Polster, raised in a secular household, remembers when she first converted to conservative Judaism, how awkward the rituals her religion seemed.
You know, as I'm covering my shelves with foil and, you know, sitting with the toothbrush in the crevices of my oven, how is this bringing you closer to God? How is this meaningful, you know, that you're sitting on your hands and knees scrubbing an appliance? But I think that's part of the journey.
Learning new practices is hard enough, but converts say what is even harder is dealing with whispers that somehow the new converts are not fully Jewish.
It was my first time in Israel, and I was on a bus, and I remember breaking down in tears and sharing on the microphone to the whole bus my fear and alienation that had emerged in being told that I wasn't really Jewish. I wasn't really an authentic Jew because my mother was not Jewish.
Diane Faith Lilly also says she heard those murmurs.
I heard the whispers of, I'm not sure they're really Jewish. I'm not sure about the conversion. And when you hear the whispers of that you're not really Jewish, I felt like then I didn't fully belong. I didn't fully belong with the Jews, but I'd left Christianity. Where am I?
According to Rabbi Maury Chernow, that whispering happens all too often.
It's definitely out there, and I hate to hear it. It's really tough and heartbreaking. I tell people that when they convert, in our eyes, they are 100% a Jew. There's no distinction between me and them. They can study Torah, they can teach Torah, they can become a rabbi. But I also give people a heads up that that sentiment is out there, and I try to reassure them that that's more about the person saying them than anything coming from the Jewish tradition.
Troubled by what she heard and feeling she had deeper spiritual needs, Faith Lilly converted from Reform to Orthodox Judaism, a two-year process she found daunting.
In Orthodox Judaism, you're required to do things. In Reform Judaism, there's not as many requirements. You have to be what's called Shomer Shabbat, so that means you don't drive on Shabbat, you don't cook, you have a kosher kitchen, and they have you practice. In my case, I had to practice having a kosher kitchen for almost a year before the rabbi would kosher my kitchen. Observing all these laws, it can be overwhelming.
Rabbi Yanklowitz says conversion to Orthodox Judaism should be easier and more inclusive, but that it is becoming just the opposite.
Orthodoxy in the 21st century has become more exclusive, stringent, and centralized in its authority than it's been in all of Jewish history. And what's at risk is the most traditional form of Judaism becoming more parochial than it's ever been before.
For some converts like Iris Feinstein, Reform Judaism, with fewer demands than Orthodox, is ideal.
The pressure level was not as strong as when you try to decide to become Orthodox. And I definitely fell in love with my synagogue. So for me, I never really thought about doing something a bit more rigorous. Now the Reform movement, I think it's just what fits me.
And even converts to conservative Judaism, like Virginie Polster, say what seemed rigorous is now a source of comfort.
It's meaningful to me. And so as long as I just try to stay focused on why is it that we do what we do, to transmit a tradition, to transmit wisdom, to transmit values, to connect to different things, to make the world a holier place, to make life more holy, those are the things that matter. And so that's what I focus on.
Some rabbis estimate that 3 of 4 people who start the conversion process finish. What is so appealing to Diane and Virginie and Iris is the strong sense of community, of history, and what many converts say is a two-way dialogue with God.
When I first started going to temple, I realized that opinions and debate were encouraged. It was that exchange with the congregation and, you know, with yourself with God, and I really enjoy that.
But more is at issue here than personal fulfillment. Judaism is a religion struggling with dwindling numbers and an increase in interfaith marriage.
I'm more concerned with strengthening the identity of Jews that we have and Jewish institutions that we have. I think that is probably a way to increase our numbers. If we're doing great things, more people are going to say, hey, what's that about? I think I want to be part of that.
The Jewish people need more converts. Converts bring in diversity into the community. People from other faith backgrounds or nationalisms enter the community and expand the consciousness of the Jewish people. For Judaism to survive in the 21st century and beyond, it needs to be broad. And to not accept converts in the most inclusive way possible challenges that breadth and potentially narrows who we are.
Conversion, says Iris Feinstein, makes me proud, Diane Faith Lilly says it gives her an identity. It gives me peace, says Virginia Polster. Enriching them, the converts say, and enriching Judaism as well. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Phoenix.
Sister Marianne Walsh died this week at the age of 68. She was a journalist and a longtime spokesperson for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. She was known for her tough yet friendly ways of dealing with members of the press. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.